Okay, we're live. Max, welcome on the podcast.
Thanks, Jake, for the invitation. You really got a rock solid podcast. I really enjoyed the first episode so far. They're awesome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for listening. That's the key, is that people actually tune in. So thank you. So I like to start nice and heavy and get straight into it. I didn't come across Austrian economics until I found Bitcoin. So Bitcoin taught me about Austrian economics. From when we met in Bali, I feel like Austrian economics came first for you from memory. I think that's quite unusual, but or to me it is at least, because it's such a kind of a niche form of economics. So where I'd like to start is, what does liberty mean to you?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say liberty is the a system where private property is upheld, right? Where ultimately you have control and ownership over your body and your resources. And if other people violate that, right? If someone hurts you physically, if they steal your goods, then the system has some method of bringing justice to the victim. And if this is upheld, then I think we are in a system of liberty.
Awesome. And I love how concise that is. I often think the people that understand their shit the best are able to give you really concise answers. And so, does liberty exist today?
That's another great question. I would say it can, but you have to work a lot. It's not the default, so to say, right? We live in a quite state-controlled environment where there are a lot of monopolies, specifically the monopoly on justice, right? There is one highest court, and that is fully controlled by the state. And if that court speaks a judgment, then there is no recourse for you to do anything else about that. However, there is, to stay on the theme of justice, there is a flourishing market of arbitration courts, private arbitration courts for numerous different industries that have a competitive relationship among each other, right? And when you get a judgment from one court, there's nothing that prevents you from going to a second arbitration court and getting a second opinion, so to say, on the case. And that means we do have quite a good competitive environment and not a monopoly. And so in many aspects, you can create a system around yourself and your property that is in fact protective of and bringing justice to people who violate it. Of course, if the aggressor is the state, then things become quite difficult. But even in those cases, there are ways to be safe and protected. So we there's always liberty. I think anarchy is a thing that's always achievable, but in today's world you have to work in order to get the benefits of it ultimately.
And what I think I have loved most about these type of discussions is they feel real and they kind of make sense. Contrary to a lot of, in hindsight, Keynesian economics that I studied going through business school. And I've used this phrase before, but like, I'm highly trained in how to make money, but I never asked the question, what is money? And that's just absolutely mind-blowing what that very small point means. And so, Max, for people that haven't come across you before, I obviously had the pleasure of meeting you in person and listening to a number of your previous appearances on podcasts. How did you get into Austrian economics in the very first place? And from my perspective, at least, coming across it later in life has helped me see the world for what it actually is. But I'm jealous in a way that it took me 20 years more to get to that point. And because I believe it was like, way earlier. So why were you looking into Austrian economics as a young guy?
I guess I have to thank my mother for that, because she really pushed me to get a job and be productive. And in hindsight, I'm the biggest fan of child labor. I think being productive early on, of course, on a voluntary basis, right,
You can't trigger people that easily, Max. Come on, mate.
No, but I mean, it's true. Like that, working is a pleasure. It's a joy because you're helping others, right? And you're solving their problems. And that's something that's not just deeply human, it's deeply rewarding. And so getting that lesson early was incredibly valuable for me in hindsight. And specifically, I bring it up because it led me to think about economics and be curious about, why do we even work in the first place, right? Because I mean, I wasn't always the happiest when I had to go out in raining weather to deliver the newspapers, right? That's not a nice thing to do. Work isn't really leisure. It's quite the opposite. And so I was curious of why do we even do this as humans? Why do we work? And so I looked for answers to those questions, and I picked up some economics books, and they were similar to you, Keynesian, right? And I had the exact same reaction to you of like, this makes no sense, and it's not useful. This is not answering the questions of why do we work? What is work, right? And why should we do it in the first place? So I kept looking ultimately, and I found Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, and that started to make a little bit more sense. And then ultimately I found Mises and later on Rothbard, and that was just so spot on the money, right? Like specifically Rothbard has such a eloquent, effortless, and approachable way of describing the problems and walking you through the solutions in such a manner that you simply cannot disagree with the statements provided. They are so logically sound and bulletproof and holistically analyzed that I've never found someone who seriously read Rothbard and disagreed with him, because it's just, it's logically bulletproof. And it was so useful, right? It, like I said, like work is solving other people's problems. That's ultimately a lesson from the Austrian school. And that changes your mindset on what work is, right? From a drudgery, you know, just to get money, a chore, exactly, to something that is almost spiritual. Right, we're helping our brothers, our fellow men, to live better lives, to remove their uneasiness, as Ludwig von Mises would say, and that's just awesome, you know. And then specifically, if we, you know, get into the money topic, if you solve someone's problem so good, right, if you've done such a great job that he's willing to give you Bitcoin for it, like the most magical, precious money in cyberspace, right, something that's so hard to get more of. And someone is willing to give it to you just because you've solved the problem. That's such a rewarding feedback, you know, like someone really appreciates the work that you've done. So getting paid is some of the most appreciative actions that others can do. And it's just a great reward. So all of this, ultimately my love for economics came from being an entrepreneur and trying to understand why we do that. And then the more I learned about entrepreneurship, the more I fell in love with it.
And it's funny because I don't really think of that relationship as like a happy one somehow. I feel like you're either an entrepreneur or you're an economist, but really they're the same thing in a sense. And that's kind of, in some ways, now I think about it, because of the state of economics today, it's just so far removed from the real world. And I remember once there was a smart girl. She was doing an English literature degree or something, and she was one of my friend's girlfriends at the time, and I was able to reel off to her the, you know, central bank is able to control interest rates, which helps with inflation, which helps with demand and disposable income, and then this magical employment number and the big loop. And she was quite impressed at the time, but when now I think about it, like 20 years old, you're just regurgitating the textbook, right? There's no like, okay, well, hang on, how do I create value? And that you're at business school, right? How on earth is that not like absolutely central? So it must have been very, very helpful to have that as a base. And so then take us through to, like, you know, entrepreneurial things that you've got involved in, Max, and some of the highlights of that experience.
Well, you know, there is the saying of from cleaning plates to a millionaire. I'm not sure if it's a saying in English, but it is in German. And I kind of did this with one step before. Like I first delivered newspapers, and that job started, I think, when I was 9 or something like this. And then went to restaurants afterwards and worked a lot there. And working in restaurants is tough. So that actually gives you some good work ethic. It's also physically demanding. You walk quite a lot as a waiter. And I worked a bit in an Italian gelato place, you know, ice cream and coffee. So this was fun. There, I think, was the first time where I really thought more about running a business, and you know, what products could we offer to our customers? What do they want? You know, what new things could we do? So yeah, I was there when we renovated the place and brought new life into a rather old kitchen, so to say. And This was then, when I did that for quite a long time, working in different restaurants and such. And then I joined Deutsche Bank for 3 years during my bachelor's degree, which is quite a lovely program in Germany, actually, where you have 3 months of practical work and then 3 months of university education. And again, 3 months of work, 3 months of school.
Wow.
And that is lovely because you get the hands-on experience, right? It's not only the theoretical part.
It's not just regurgitating the exam. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I'm a big fan of this type of apprenticeship almost, even at the university level. And here I really just saw, into the belly of the beast of what is fiat money printing and what does a big bank actually do? And all while this, I was again deep into Austrian economics. And just after I signed that 3-year contract with Deutsche Bank, I discovered Bitcoin for the second time. So this was something like, I went to the bank to learn more about banking and money, but now I found the solution. And the solution is not the old system. The solution is a new system. Right? And then I finished the degree and after 3 years. But already during that, I started my career in free and open source Bitcoin and freedom tech. And there I joined numerous projects. One of the lovely ones was to create a lot of educational videos on the World Crypto Network. Lots of tutorials, starting with, again, the economics and the philosophy of money, but then more and more getting interested into the technology and walking through different software implementations, for example, BISC, a decentralized exchange, or hardware wallets like the Cold Card or full nodes like the Noddle. And one of the projects that really caught my heart, so to say, was Wasabi Wallet, a desktop Bitcoin wallet where you can receive and send Bitcoin, but tailor-made for improving the privacy of the end user. And by that point, I already was a fledgling cypherpunk, so to say. I really understood the value of anonymity online and the beauty of cryptography and what it enables us. And I saw the real need of having a private experience in Bitcoin, which is quite inherently a rather public network. And so I joined that team to make Wasabi as great as it could possibly be. And again, started from just doing, educational videos, interviews with the developers. I wrote the documentation and then went more and more into the project development space until eventually becoming the CEO of the company CK Snacks that offered the core CoinJoin coordination service of Wasabi, which was a beautiful company. One of the few profitable businesses denominated in Bitcoin. We scaled that team up to 40 people and had a hell of a ride, which unfortunately we had to end. But then since then, I'm just continuously helping freedom tech proliferate. And that's quite a mission and a joy, I would say.
Wow. So many cool things to touch on, Max. I think what's cool is this idea of being grounded in the Austrian economics that you've studied and that curious nature that is like, well, that doesn't make sense. Let me try and find something else that does make a bit more sense. It raises the bar on what represents an opportunity. And I'm guilty of this myself, where it's like that whole idea of being like a headless chicken. You want to do well, you want to do well, you want to do well. But like, what is well? You know what I mean? So it's like you've been able to upgrade your software from a perspective of like what is value to then go and make a bunch of decisions. And here you are today. Do you think that base of Austrian economics helped you with that, specifically how I described?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there has been much that was more influential on not just my professional life, but also my personal life than Austrian economics. Mm. Because it's just such a beautiful way at looking at human action and human interaction, right? Of why do we help each other, right? And one of the great realizations that came to mind as you spoke is the comparative advantage, right? That not
it
just,
is.
If you focus on what you're better at than someone else and he focus on what he's better at than you, then obviously you can trade and improve your output in life. But it goes more than that. That even if Jake, for example, let's say you are, a great mathematician and also a great typewriter. And you're better in both of these things than me, right? Then, but you are, let's say, the better mathematician, then you are a typewriter, and I'm a better typewriter than I'm a mathematician, so to say. Then now, despite you being better in both of these things, we can still trade productively if we focus on the thing that we are individually marginally better at. Right? That's such a crazy outcome that a full genius can still work with a retard, so to say. And it's profitable, it's productive, right? Economic teaches that it doesn't matter that you're not the smartest in the room, right? It really doesn't. You don't have to be the best at anything. You just have to focus on the things that you are better at than yourself, right? Focus on what you individually are best at and do that with a passion and with full time, and you will be a profitable entrepreneur in this entire market economy. And that's such a beautiful realization that there is no human, no wasted human life, right? Regardless who you are, regardless where you are, regardless how skilled you are, you can be a productive and a positive member to society whom people will value, right? Whom people will pay you for, because you focus on that thing that you are best at. And that's just a beautiful realization.
And so for some reason I've been taken to like school, and how in some ways it churns out generalists, or it churns out, once you include a university degree, people with higher level education, but there's no market demand for them. You meet people with like 3 degrees, but they're doing a really very, very standard job. And in some ways, I think part of that is the misallocation of capital that a money printer allows for. If that was all private free market business, no one would be doing that, basically. But it's that idea that you can take feedback from people around what you're actually really good at. Because people will tell you, right? Oh, we really like you telling us stories, or we really like you writing us stories, or we really like you, you know, creating videos, or whatever it might be. Oh, that's a market feedback that's useful. Do more of that. Whereas it's probably not, can you cook me dinner every day? Because someone else is better at that. And I think what you've highlighted well is it's understanding that fact helps you guide you through life. Because otherwise, there's just, you can do anything, but you can't be great at everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, like if you focus yourself on for 10,000 hours on a subject and really go deep, you're going to be a master at it, pretty much regardless of what it is, right? Humans are extremely capable of learning given that dedication and focus. And, you know, being a generalist might be your speciality, so to say, but ultimately it doesn't have to be, right? And it can be something extremely mundane, you know, like, I don't know, laying carpets or, you know, being a plumber, right? Like the physical labor of it is something that is extremely valuable, right? And this, as long as you're dedicated and eager to improve yourself, right? You can disregard all of the comparisons to other people, because it ultimately doesn't really matter. What truly matters is what is your best skill compared to yourself, right? What do you prefer at? And if you focus on that, then it's quite likely that you're going to get so great at it that people are happy to pay you for it. And there's this concept of the ikigai, I think from Japanese philosophy.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So do the thing that you're great at, right? Do the thing that's valuable for the world, right? And do the thing that you can get paid for, right? And things that other people value. And finding that middle point between these aspects, that's a great life's mission or life's work. And there are so many different types of work that you could specialize yourself on, which is another beautiful thing that economics teaches, right? That the economy is so incredibly complex. Nobody knows how to produce a pencil, right? Something as naive,
yeah,
as simple,
wild, isn't it?
As a pencil. We have no idea. Nobody knows how this is actually made. Because if you would analyze every step in the production chain, you just see that it's a fractal rabbit hole that gets deeper and deeper the closer you look. And so just pick anything that fancies your heart and get really good at it, and you're going to make a marginally great contribution to society.
Cool. And that's great advice for anyone out there thinking about what they might do. Now, this example has cropped up very nicely because I think it would be awesome to hear you pull this together, so to speak. But the fact that no one understands how to make a pencil as an individual, fascinating insights like how trade actually works, in that we're no longer small tribes with 100 people in. And I found Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money, incredibly insightful for such an early stage. Like, that was credit. So credit has existed forever and will probably continue to do so. Anyone tells you that debt's not going to exist, I don't necessarily agree with that as a result of thinking about that specific scenario. Prices help dictate behavior in a marketplace, and prices are used with different types of money. And this is one of the awesome things about thinking about the history of money, and it pulls it all into like perspective. You're like, oh, we've tried all these different things, and Bitcoin's just another iteration of this process. But when it comes to the pencil, like, how important is it that the money you're using is functioning correctly to actually create something like a pencil?
Yeah, it's absolutely important to have a money, to have a medium of exchange, right? That to coordinate all of these things, because without trade, you don't have prices, right? And prices, specifically denominated in money, are extremely useful because value is subjective, right? And value is ordinal, meaning you can't really put a number on it. You cannot say that I like the banana 10 times more than, you know, the apple, for example. That's not how value works. You can say I prefer a banana to an apple, but that doesn't really help you with the question of how many bananas or apples should we produce, right? So because of private property, we can exchange the ownership title to a good. And with this exchange, we all of a sudden introduce a comparative value, right? Like, for how many apples do you trade one banana, so to say? And then with the creation of more and more exchange, eventually we will find a more saleable good, a more marketable good, and that is money, right? And if we have a good that anyone is willing to trade for, then all of a sudden we have a money that we can impress prices in, because what's the quantity of that money good that people are selling their stuff for? And this allows us to do calculation, right? Meaning of which resources should be used for what. Should we use wood, steel, or gold to build our house? Right? All three of them are possible options, but the three of them have a different supply and demand, and therefore different prices, and therefore different rationale. You know, maybe it's not the best use of gold to build, you know, a 1 meter thick wall, castle, so to say. That's a lot of gold, and we don't have that much of it. So maybe we should use something else for producing this, right? And wood is quite abundant, but, you know, it's not as long lasting. And after a couple of years, you might have to swap things out. So maybe steel is the correct option, right? But to really get to the question of where do we allocate our scarce resources, that's an extremely crucial point, because resources are scarce, meaning once we have allocated them to something, we cannot go back, right? There is no double spending of resources, so to say. Once you transform a bar of steel into an engine, right? You cannot easily get back because the engine is extremely complex. And plus, it took you a lot of time and effort and machinery and other resources to get to that point. And that means we, in our production stages, we increase the sophistication, so to say, of our resources into more and more narrow things, right? A bar of steel can be applied to millions of different actions, so to say, or products, but an engine block only to very few. So we can do less things with an engine block, but the things that we can do are, of course, much greater than what we could with a bar of steel. A bar of steel will never move you from place A to B, but an engine could potentially, right? So by increasing the roundaboutness of our production stages, we get to more useful goods ultimately. There is a step too far, right? What if we consume so many resources in the production of specific deeper production stage products that ultimately we run out, right? And then we cannot finish producing the car because we're missing, I don't know, rubber for the gaskets or something like this. And these very complex products that we're enjoying nowadays rely on the correct application of scarce resources through time and space, not just for one good, but for a gazillion of different types of goods that we produce nowadays. So this is an utterly incredibly complex phenomenon. Like, the modern market economy is a miracle. And it is based on property rights and on trade and on money, right? And if we start messing with the money, then we mess with the entire market structure. And if someone can print money at very cheap cost, then he's going to spend it on more frivolous things, right? On things that are not really fitting to the actual demand that he has. If it's easy for you to get money, you spend it on stuff that you might not even really need that much. Versus if you actually have to work, then your demand is going to be much more realistic to what you can afford. And so increasing the money supply ultimately means that we mess with the demand structure of the market. And so we consume more resources than we otherwise would have. And we invest more resources than we otherwise would have, which means we're lowering the resource count on both ends, right? We're consuming and we're specifying the resources into more narrowly scoped production. And if that happens on a large economic scale, then at first we think we're all rich and look, everyone's building new houses made out of gold. That's fantastic, right? That's the boom period, economically speaking. But sooner or later, you realize that, well, we've literally consumed all of the resources. There is no more steel to finish the engine. There is no more wood to finish the construction of the house. And that's not just a thing that one entrepreneur did wrong or miscalculated. It's a strategic problem for the entire economy. And that's the bust, ultimately, when we realize that at large, at a society, we've overconsumed and we've malinvested our resources into stuff that we don't actually need. And therefore, even the things that we do need, right, like shelter, like food, for those valuable critical things, we don't have the resources anymore to fix them or to finish them. And that's the death of society. And I think to a large part, it starts with the abolition of private property, which in a more specific analysis is the inflation of the money supply. And that is the root of all evil.
What an awesome explanation. Thank you, Max. It's a big day when you realize that money is 50% of every transaction. You're like, what the hell is this thing? Even the phrase, the most saleable good, was like, oh, money's actually a thing. I don't know, yeah. It sounds really stupid, but like you hadn't even really ever thought about what is money. And hence, it's such an important question to ask. That's, you know, the reason we're even on this call, for example. So what, in your mind, are good examples of the misallocation of resources as a result of fucking around with the money supply that you see going on around you? And I always like, I think it was Parker Lewis I heard once talking about, like, you mentioned the word miracle. Walk into a grocery store anywhere and just think about how much human interaction and trade has been required to get every single one of those items on the shelves in that shop. And then consider what it means if every single one of those decisions that were made economically to bring an idea to physical form in a marketplace was using the wrong measuring stick. And it's kind of like, whoa, you just, like, half this stuff probably wouldn't even be here. But like, anyway, that's a bit of context for you to run with.
Yeah, one of my favorite, very mundane daily examples of the fuck up that fiat brought us is dishwasher taps, right? What do you need to help a dishwasher clean stuff better? Just need soap, right? And you can produce this very easily in a powder form with like three basic ingredients. It's baking soda, some citric acid, and one or two other powder ingredients. And all of a sudden you have a powder that you can put the majority of a spoon you put into that little basket, that holds the soap. But you would also like to add some soap to the pre-wash, right? Because first it runs the washer and cleans the worst of it and cleans better with soap, right? So you don't need that much soap in the pre-wash because it's only going to run for a short time. So you just put a little bit of the spoon in the general vicinity of the dishwasher, right? That's how the dishwashers were designed. You have two runs of cleaning, so you need two batches of soap. Very easy to do if you just have a spoon and powder, right? Very simple. You can do it at home. You know, nothing fancy. It will take you 5 minutes to produce.
Don't worry about trying this at home, guys. Yeah.
No, I mean, do actually like make your own dishwasher soap. Like it's super simple. And what do we have nowadays on the market? We have these fancy like packs of you know, this weird kind of plasticky gel that has like five different chambers, you know, maybe with some powder in the back of it, but then there's a red liquid and a blue liquid and a green liquid, right? So all different types of soap. And we now need to produce not only this weird gel that dissolves in water, not just the actual washing powder, but also the different liquids with God knows what exactly is in them, right? And the coloring for all of this and the machinery to put it together in this form factor, right? Plus, we need to deliver it to the store in a nice packaging and so on. And maybe there's even a plastic wrapper around each of them. So we have now a production stage that all of a sudden involves thousands of people, right? Like researchers, scientists, you know, manufacturer, producers. We need to produce the machines. So all of a sudden we need to get the ore, to get the steel, right? And produce a bunch of electricity and pay for the coffee of all of the workers, etc. So we've increased the roundaboutness of something as simple as dishwasher soap, right? It cost us so much more to produce it. And the product is worse, right? Because now everyone just takes this one, you know, one tab and puts it into the little basket. And that's it, right? Nobody puts two of these things, one extra into the pre-wash because, well, they're expensive, right? Why would you waste one in the pre-wash? So nobody's putting soap in the pre-wash anymore. So that means that the dishwasher doesn't work anymore because it doesn't clean without soap. And now all of a sudden we have to increase the intensity of the soapness of the main wash because it didn't clean in the pre-wash. And now you have to go back and re-engineer everything to have a much stronger washing detergent in these little packs, right? So something as simple as dishwasher soap that you can produce in 5 minutes by yourself at home, right, all of a sudden requires numerous factories and numerous energy producers and numerous researchers and scientists to ultimately give you a worse product. And that is the increased roundaboutness of a fiat economy.
Wow, I didn't expect to be promoting the benefits of making my own dishwasher powder. That's fucking awesome. But it's always so helpful, though, to bring like real life examples in. And thank you for sharing that. So, Max, I'd like to take a slightly different direction now, which is shout out to Andrew Bailey, who I also met in Bali, came on the show recently, and his book, Resistance Money, which I confess I still haven't finished yet, but it had an excellent section on why cash is private. And it really helped me think about things slightly differently from before. And the context being, you know, when I receive cash, whether I'm selling a good or service, I don't know where it came from. And I don't need to know where it came from, because in some senses, it's a kind of bare asset. Now, when I go and spend that cash, it's also private. Like the person I'm giving it to doesn't know where it's come from, and they don't need to know where it's come from. So I think his phrase, you have backwards and forwards privacy in terms of the kind of the time, the chain of events that money goes through. Now, you spent a number of years thinking about what this means in the digital realm. And you know, thank God for Satoshi, right? What an awesome inventor, wherever they are. The idea of digital peer-to-peer cash is very, very important. But Bitcoin being a public ledger, it isn't very easy to send cash to someone with backwards and forwards privacy. So could you talk to people about why that problem is the case? And we'll take it from there.
Yeah, that's a huge topic and a super important one. And to me, in the white paper titled "The Cash," wasn't really about, you know, the payment mechanism or something like this, but it was about the aspect of it being base money, right? Cash is the base money of the fiat economy, meaning it's money that does not have any counterparty risk. It's like a gold bar, right? It's the thing itself. It's the actual good. It's the money good, right? And the counterpart to that would be you take your piece of gold, you put it in a money warehouse, and you get a paper slip that says whoever has this paper has the piece of gold, right? Owns the piece of gold. That paper is no longer cash, so to say. It's no longer base money. It's a claim on base money. Mm-hmm. And what we've had is, since 1983, at least in theory, was a digital form of a money warehouse receipt, as Rothbard would call it. Right? That is what David Chaum came up with, eCash, where you put your gold or your fiat money into a special bank account, let's say, you know, 1,000 units, $1,000. And in exchange, you get from the bank, from the money warehouse provider, a digital signature, right, that basically represents that the ownership to the underlying cash in the bank. And you can now give someone else the signature, right, and he can give it back to the money warehouse of saying, hey, please, I want to get a new signature, a new token, so to say, to represent the current ownership title. And so the bank basically provides the timestamping aspect, because one of the issues is that if I have the digital token, I could give it first to Jake, right, and then later to Brian, and it's the same piece of data. I just control C, control V, right, and copy it twice. And all of a sudden we have inflation and it costs me nothing to produce more money. That's a horrible system, right? So we need a way to prevent inflation, to prevent that the same coin can be spent twice. And so David Chaum figured this out very early, that this is extremely simple to prevent double spending if we have a trusted third party, a central server that keeps record of which transaction came first, right, and honors that transaction and recognizes that a second attempt to spend the same coin is invalid and removes that transaction and doesn't honor it, right? Of course, the downside with having such a central system is that now the third party knows exactly who is spending money to whom, right? How does the money move from one hand to the other? And so David Chaum fixed this already in 1983 by the application of some beautiful cryptography called blind signatures, right? Where basically when I give the bank the cash deposit, so to say, I put my note in an envelope and give the sealed envelope to the bank. Right? The bank verifies that, yes, these are 1,000 cash dollars and they're valid. So I will sign the envelope on the outside and give it back to you. Right? So you've made a signature on a document that the bank doesn't even see. It's a blind signature on a document that it doesn't know. Right? And now the end user can open up the envelope, cryptographically speaking, and have the inside paper, the actual token that is signed, you know, with a carbon copy of the signature that was applied on the outside envelope. And now this is the token, the contract that the bank has not seen because it blindly signed it as it was inside the envelope. And I can give that inside token to someone else who can then present it to the bank of like, hey, here's a valid signature for $1,000 that you've made. Please give me the $1,000 cash. And now the bank has no idea which token or when this token was created, because it has never seen the token. It has only seen the envelope with the token inside. Right? So a beautiful cryptographic system that allows us to make instant and extremely fast, extremely private transactions. And that worked in 1983, or the first implementations in the early 1990s. By the way, now we see a resurgence of this eCash system, not backed by US dollars, but backed by Bitcoin and protocols like Cashew or Fediment, which is beautiful technology. But the problem with this old system was that we have a single entity, a single server that can control how many tokens are being issued. Right? The bank can just create a million signatures on these envelopes that it created itself. Right? And all of a sudden, we only have $1,000 in the cash in the bank, but we have 100,000 tokens. Right? And this is a fractional reserve banking system, which Austrian economics tells us will blow up eventually, because, well, if the 100,000 tokens want to be redeemed for cash, then there's only 1,000 in the bank, that obviously doesn't work out. So this very private, very fast payment system is not a base money system. It's a money substitute, a money warehouse receipt. Right? And that is not the ultimate issue that we need to solve, right? The banking isn't that broken. Right? I mean, it's not the best, but what's really broken is the base money. It's the central banking, right? It's the creation of the new monetary good that's broken. And that's ultimately what Satoshi invented, a base money system, not necessarily a payment system, but a way that we can create a new monetary asset right? A thing, we can create a good in such a way that there is no single server that controls how many units there are, and that verifies the double spending, or that does the time stamping of which transaction came first. So Satoshi invented a decentralized time stamping mechanism for ensuring that any coin can only be created once. But it all started with the creation, the decentralized creation of a new base money asset, right, where every full node verifies how many base money tokens are to be created every 10 minutes, right, 50 per block, halving every 4 year. That itself is the creation of a new base monetary asset. But the way that we can do this is that every full node has to verify every transaction of everyone else. Right? Because if I wouldn't verify the transaction that Jake is sending to Brad, then Jake could create 100 new tokens out of nothing. Right? So I have to verify the transaction of everyone else in order to be sure that nobody created more money than he should have. And this leads to two major problems that were identified instantly as soon as Satoshi published his idea, his white paper. This doesn't scale because it is not private. Right? If I have to verify every transaction of everyone else, not just is that mass surveillance, right? But also how powerful of a computer would we need in order to verify all the thousands of transactions that every human is doing every day, that every AI agent is going to do every second, right? This is simply not feasible for any one person to verify all of the actions of everyone else. And that the privacy aspect and the scalability aspects are very tightly linked. But let's stick on the privacy side first, because one of the problems is that if I pay you now, Jake, you can look on the blockchain, right, and see every transaction that came in the past, right? Where did that address get its money from? In which transaction? And what transaction paid those addresses that paid the following one, right? You have this chain of transactions, or more of a network of transactions, that you can follow all the way back to when that unit of base money was first created in the block, right? And this is a privacy downside, right? Now I know not just how often did you make transactions in the past, but also quite likely I can find out how much money do you have in total, right? And also, where do you spend the money in the future? Simply by looking at and analyzing the transactions that you have to tell me, right? In order to make a Bitcoin transaction, you have to reveal yourself to the entire network. And that is not a private system. If you don't have the choice to not reveal yourself to the world, that is not a privacy-preserving system. And so that is quite a downside. And there are, however, numerous solutions to them. And one we already briefly mentioned was Wasabi Wallet and the concept of a coin join, where instead of making a transaction by yourself alone, you know, spending your own money and sending it to the merchant and back to yourself, the change, right? Instead of doing that by yourself, you team up with hundreds of others of people, right? And create this gigantic transactions that doesn't just spend one input and create two outputs, but we're spending hundreds of inputs and we're creating hundreds of outputs. And all of a sudden, we are inside of a crowd. We're no longer a single guy on stage. We're in a crowd of people where money moves, right? And quite privately so. So this is a beautiful solution that actually works, and to the best of my knowledge, has not yet been broken, to really spend money privately. Now, if I would pay Jack, then you could look on the blockchain and you could see the transaction that paid you, but that transaction has hundreds of inputs, right? And you have no idea which of these inputs actually paid which of the outputs. And likewise, if you would use a coin join to spend your money in the future, then I wouldn't know where you spent the money from, right? Because I see that there is a transaction that spends the coin that I gave you. But again, there are hundreds of other inputs and hundreds of other outputs. And I don't know how many inputs or outputs you even have in this transaction. So coin join is a technique of improving the privacy of Bitcoin by providing you with cover traffic, so to say. Right, by teaming up with other people to increase the size of the crowd, to make it more difficult to analyze who is paying whom. And the second interesting solution to this problem is the Lightning Network. Because with the Lightning Network, we have a secure way of paying someone Bitcoin without having to reveal this transaction to everyone on the blockchain, right? We can make transaction off-chain, so to say, which means that only the receiver and sender of this transaction know that the transaction happened even. And we don't have to reveal to the entire world that this address just paid this address so and much Bitcoin. But we do that in a payment channel or even routed across payment channels without the need to broadcast this transaction to everyone. So the Lightning Network is not just an improvement in privacy, it's also an improvement in scalability. Right? It's more private because you don't have to tell others your transactions, and that means it's more scalable as well. We can make more transactions without everyone having to verify them. And so CoinJoin is a way to improve the privacy of Bitcoin by increasing the size of the crowd, by creating a bit of chaos and confusion in the transactions that everyone verifies. And the Lightning Network is an improvement in privacy and scalability by making secure transactions that don't have to be verified by everyone else.
Honestly, that's a wonderful explanation as to like why this is important and what some of the solutions that are coming out of this actually are. I think what it comes back to, though, is this idea that Bitcoin is a bearer asset, which is another phrase I came across in this process that really resonated very strongly. It's like, you know, if I send you my Bitcoin, it's gone. I cannot get it back. And the digital world is so easy just to copy information. And so the idea that Bitcoin is the first time that we came across digital scarcity is a really powerful concept. You're like, oh, okay, that kind of clicks now. But it's the fact that it doesn't change, it's your foundation, your bedrock, however you might want to look at it, that then these additional tools like Lightning can sit on top of it and be like, well, we know that a fraction of the Bitcoin network went into the Lightning network. Therefore, whatever transactions are happening on top of it, it doesn't actually affect how the base layer is actually functioning. And it took me a long time. I mean, Layered Money was another really cool book that I came across during this process that made me start thinking about it like that. That then when you start thinking of these subjects, oh, okay, cool. As a user myself, privacy is becoming more and more important to me, but it wasn't originally obvious why. You know, it's like when you're like on Facebook sharing pictures of you and your mates getting drunk. It was fun, but you didn't really realize why. It was like you're giving away your data, which someone else is making money out of. So I'm as guilty as anyone. It's like evolving in that sense. So some of the things that have come up in terms of CoinJoin specifically, when you're developing products like that, who cares and who doesn't like it?
Yeah, that's another great question. Who cares about privacy? And I think it's the people who have something to protect. And if you have property that you don't want stolen from, what are your possible strategies of how can you prevent someone from stealing your money? And, you know, of course, you can have a lot of guns and, you know, anyone who comes at you, you shoot him ultimately. That's one way of dealing with the problem. But a much more elegant and a much cheaper solution to the problem is simply don't tell the adversary that you have money. If nobody knows that you exist and nobody knows how much money you have and where you're keeping it, etc., all of a sudden, it becomes much more difficult to attack you, because whom exactly should you attack as an adversary if you don't know who exists in the first place? And if you don't know if that person has a lot of money or little money, right? So privacy is a very cheap form of defense. And in terms of game theory, you are secure or the entire system is secure if the cost of defense is very low and the cost of attack is very high. Right? That means that everyone can afford to protect themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But and anyone is not really incentivized to attack because there is a praxeology of violence, right? Thieves are entrepreneurs too, ultimately, and they have costs in their business and expenses, and they have revenue, and you know the difference between that is profit or loss. And so if you have to spend tens of Bitcoin on surveillance and machinery and labor in order to pull off a heist, but then at the end you only receive one Bitcoin from the victim, well, you've just lost 9 Bitcoin. You've decreased your capital, and that's a loss, right? And eventually you're just going to run out of capital. You won't be able to fund the next operation. So that means privacy, as an incredible defense technology is highly appreciated by the victims, right? The people who are being attacked, the people who are being stolen from, they appreciate privacy a lot. And privacy is very disliked by the attackers, right? By the thieves, ultimately, because it makes their job more difficult. And so this includes, you know, private individuals who are stealing. We've seen numerous kidnappings of wealthy individuals, and specifically Bitcoiners, because people think that they're rich, right? Maybe because they know that they've been in Bitcoin for, you know, a long time, and therefore, you know, it's not a unreasonable conclusion to think that they have a decent amount of stack. Or there might also be, for example, you know, you make a peer-to-peer trade somewhere and you sell $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, and maybe you meet the same guy again next week and you sell another $1,000, and okay, you meet him again a month later, and all of a sudden, you know, he comes with a gun and says, "Hey, I looked on the blockchain and you only sold me $1,000 worth, but I see on the blockchain that you made a transaction where the input is 1,000 Bitcoin. I would like to have 1,000 Bitcoin now, not just $1,000 worth," right? And that has happened numerous times, right? So the ability to make private transactions specifically with the protect you specifically from the people whom you're dealing with in your everyday transactions, right? And of course, it goes to the nation state level as well, right? A lot of the nation state relies on taxation, which is a form of theft, right? These are not consensual transactions. Of course, they would prefer to not have citizens that are private. They would very much prefer a system of taxation that cannot be hidden from, right? That's where the term daylight robbery, by the way, comes from. Because back in England, where common law was still a thing, which unfortunately now it is not, there was a thing like the home is the castle. And the taxman did not have the legal authority to enter the house and see the amount of wealth that you have inside, like how many gold coins does the subject have available. That was not allowed by law, right? It was a rather private system, so to say. So the solution was to tax what was visible. So the tax rate that you had to pay as a subject was dependent on the number and size of windows in your house, because that was something the taxman could see from the outside. You could not hide the number of windows that you have, right? And so the obvious protection mechanism, unfortunately, was to decrease the size and quantity of your windows. So a lot of old houses have their windows laid full of bricks to decrease the tax burden of individuals. Yeah, so this was why we call taxation daylight robbery, because it literally robbed the daylight of honest people.
Is that right?
Who had to shut down their windows, right?
I've seen many houses in England growing up that had bricked-in windows. Yeah, my old house did even. Amazing.
So ultimately, privacy benefits the victim, right? And a surveillance benefits the attacker. And so if we create systems that are used widely by people and that have privacy as a default, then all of a sudden we substantially increase the cost of attack for any type of adversary. And if we create tools and software that have this default utilization of privacy at a cheap rate, then we decrease the cost of defense, right? And I believe that that's the closest path to world peace, so to say, that we have. It's a cypherpunk world where privacy is safeguard and any attack is simply not profitable anymore.
So cool. And wow, again, Bitcoin just teaches you so much, but like, what is a cypherpunk? I don't know. Okay, let's start reading about it. And you can go and find the Cypherpunk Manifesto. And you just realize like this discussion around the importance of privacy in a digital environment has been going on for a long time. And what I love about digging into it as a concept is like, it's just clearly so important. Yet, you know, you'll see announcements from the European Union saying how dangerous it is that people can use software products to use peer-to-peer monetary networks. And when you put it in the perspective of attacker and defender, it makes so much more sense. And I completely agree with you. Like, it makes the incentive to steal from people, it gets smaller and smaller the harder it is to actually do. What I'd love to run through quickly, to your mind, what is the difference between secrecy and privacy?
In the Cypherpunk Manifesto, it says that a secret is something that you don't want anyone to know. Right? That might be, for example, your private key. That's a secret information that should really just be yours, ultimately. And a private information is that something that you don't want the entire world to know. Like, you know, your bedtime conversation with your wife. You definitely want your wife to hear you. Otherwise, it would be a monologue. Or like a group chat with your family, right? Something where you do want to express yourself, but you don't want to tell everyone, including your worst enemy, the things that you're saying, right? So this I think, is a useful differentiation, right? But the thing is that as soon as we reveal something about ourselves to a third party, to someone else, now we no longer have it in our control if that other person keeps the secret, right? If he keeps something private, so to say. He might now turn around and broadcast it to the entire world, right? So to some extent, if we want something to really be kept secret, then we cannot share it with third parties, specifically with untrustworthy third parties. And unfortunately, in the early designs of the internet, any information shared was traveling through trusted intermediaries in such a way that they could actually read everything, right? And that's why people in the 1990s or 2000s were afraid to put their credit card information on a website, because anyone could see it, basically. Anyone who, or any of the numerous computers that were passing the message forward, could simply read all of the messages. And if someone knows your credit card number, then obviously they can drain money out of your account. And that shows you that it's so important to have a strong privacy in the sense that with encryption, you can pass along an encrypted credit card information. You can even publish it to the entire world. I'd make a Noster post about it. But that will not be broken. There's no way that anyone can actually get to the content of the message unless he has the private key, which again should be a secret information that is not widely known by people other than you. And so cryptography as a whole, as a science, is a tool to make it easier to reveal ourselves selectively. We can now share encrypted messages either to one person or to a group of people that, assuming the private keys are kept secret, we have a secure and reliable way of communicating with each other.
So cool. And I loved coming across that when I was thinking about it. It's like that ability to be selective about what you reveal to the world. And that can be as simple as, like, you know, when you're a teenager, don't tell your best mate who you fancy, because everyone's going to know about it, you know, even though you don't want them to. Yeah, awesome. Okay, well, Max, listen, we've run up to an hour, so I really appreciate your time. I could honestly ask a ton more questions on private property and all that kind of stuff, but we'll leave that for another time. If anyone wanted to reach out and get in touch, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, you find me nowadays exclusively on the Noster. So look up for awesome. Max at towardsliberty.com. There you can get my public key and see the posts I'm making, or encrypt a message to me so only I can read it. And as a maybe a book recommendation that's very much aligned to the conversations that we were having, is A Lodging of Wayfaring Men by Paul Rosenberg. It was written 1997 to the 2002-ish when it was published. It's actually based on a true story of the first cypherpunks who built a digital anonymous digital payment system, an anonymous digital marketplace, a digital dispute resolution and arbitration court. Basically, the entire stack of freedom technologies were built back then by a bunch of heroic cypherpunks. And the book, loosely based on these true events, shows the story. Absolutely a joy to read. And I made the podcast of that. So that's available for free on the Parallel Society podcast, which is a podcast of the author. Absolutely worth listening to those episodes. So yeah, if you want to learn more about the true spirit of the cypherpunks, this is an OG book that is a joy to read. Thanks, awesome. Jake, for the invitation.
Oh, no, thank you, Max. It's jogged my memory. I'm sure I've got it on my Kindle to read, having seen you post about it before. I just haven't yet done it. So that's a good reminder for me. There's always too many books to read, you know what I mean? Well, Max, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, this was a pleasure. Thanks, Jake. Looking forward to the next episodes as well.
Thank you, Max.